You're listening to Beltway Beef, official commentary from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association's Washington, D.C. office.
Well, hello, and welcome back to another episode of NCBA's Beltway Beef Podcast. I'm Hunter Ehrman, and today we're catching up with Sigrid Johannes, Director of the Public Lands Council and NCBA Government Affairs. Sigrid, there's always a lot going on in the climate and natural resources space. One of the things I'd like to talk about first is the sage-grouse management plans that have been released from the BLM. Could you give us an update on what's going on there?
Thanks for having me, Hunter. So the last time these plans were updated was 2019. Before that, there was a pretty significant revision in 2015. And like a lot of things in the natural resources and particularly the wildlife space, the sage-grouse management plans have become kind of a football from one administration to the next. What we're seeing this year is the Biden administration's stamp on this issue, their attempt to kind of make their own mark and carve their own strategy out for how they want to manage this species moving forward. And there's a lot of eyes on this for a number of reasons. The first one is that the sage grouse is a very iconic Western species of bird. The greater sage grouse pops up in multiple Western states. It's a native species of the sagebrush steppe, which is one of the kind of ecosystems or biomes, as we say, that is very foundational to landscapes across the Western United States. And it's considered a keystone species. So when sage grouse decline, conservationists look into that and read into that, that there's all kinds of other things going downhill in the ecosystem. So it's an interesting one to watch. It's kind of a marker for folks to watch. And that's why there's such a great interest in conserving it and conserving its habitat in the sagebrush. Where cattle enters into this and ranchers is that there's been a big push from environmentalists to kind of hijack this very well-meaning effort to conserve the sage grouse and use it to remove grazing from federal lands. This is the same playbook that we see with all kinds of species. It's nothing new, unfortunately. But when it comes to the sage grouse, like many species, we actually have very good science to support the fact that cattle and this bird can coexist. And in many cases, cattle actually improve habitat for this bird. So that's kind of what the relevance is. And there's a lot in these plans to dig into. It's a really lengthy proposal with pretty far-reaching impacts for millions of acres across the West.
So this is pretty new. Talk about what NCBA and PLC is doing to go through the management plans and what the path forward looks like for us.
Sure thing. So this is a pretty wide-ranging proposal because what it actually is doing, we say the sage-grouse plans as kind of an umbrella term, but what's actually happening is an RMPA, a resource management plan amendment, that will impact 77 separate land use plans that are currently in place across 10 Western states. So these are done at a state-by-state level. They are supposed to be pretty locally focused and pretty landscape-specific, but we sometimes still see a little bit more of a top-down, one-size-fits-all approach than we would like. And then the other thing that's happening concurrently in this rulemaking is a draft EIS through the NEPA process for six alternatives, six varieties of plans for how the grouse will be managed going forward. So there's kind of a two-track system that we're having to comment on now. Within those alternatives, there are a lot of changes to what management would look like on the ground. So there are some alternatives that are really restrictive towards oil and gas, for example. There are some that are pretty restrictive towards renewable energy. There are some that are more restrictive towards grazing. And then there are some that are a good balance of all of those things, plus some conservation measures to assist the bird and the sagebrush habitat. So we are going to be commenting during the comment period that's available here. I mentioned this is a really overarching proposal, and I think that's important to recognize because we've got more than 600 pages of documents now to parse through, courtesy of this rulemaking, and it's going to impact millions and millions of acres. This is a huge decision for Fish and Wildlife, for the BLM to make, and so we really want to make sure that we are seeing every angle here, and we think that needs more time. We think local stakeholders need more time. There's a lot of counties that want to get involved in this. Certainly state wildlife agencies have a stake in it, and then national stakeholder groups such as NCBA. So we are asking first and foremost for the BLM to extend that comment period significantly. It's currently standing at 90 days. We believe it should be a minimum of 180. And then once we get that accomplished, we will obviously dig into writing some of those more technical comments about all of the different science that we have to support the fact that cattle improve the habitat, they improve the biomass of insect species that the sage grouse needs to eat, and they help prevent fire, which is a massive factor right now in loss of habitat for this species.
Well, Sigrid, could you speak more to the relationship between grazing and sage-grouse habitat?
Absolutely. So in the past, there was a pretty heavy misconception that cattle were a disturbance, a disruptor to sage-grouse presence. Since then, in the last sort of 20 years or so, and particularly over the last 10 years with some new studies that have been undertaken in Idaho, we've seen a real shift, actually, in the conclusions that conservationists are reaching about the role that cattle plays here. You can find successful sage-grouse nesting sites, successful leks, in pretty close proximity to cattle, in some cases right on top of them in the same pastures where folks are grazing. You see them travel pretty well across fence lines. They don't seem to be too bothered by that. And you see them having really good survivability rates in the areas where cattle have been present, because cattle, through their mechanical disturbance of the soil with their hooves, through the fertilizer that they're adding to the ground through manure, and through the grazing pattern that they're, you know, employing in a permittee situation where obviously that grazing on public lands is pretty carefully restricted and pretty carefully managed, we're seeing really big improvements in the biodiversity of plants, for example, that you can find in a certain area, the biodiversity of insect species that you find in a certain area. And that diversity, that sort of restoration of native rangeland with ungulate grazing, is a really key sort of starting point for sage-grouse success. It's kind of where all of their other life activities stem from. So we found really good science to support that cattle and the bird can coexist. You always used to hear, you know, in previous years when we were working on this, they'd say what's good for the herd is good for the bird and vice versa. I would say that conclusion has only gotten stronger over the years as we've had more studies completed.
Sigrid, I'd like to shift and talk about some other species, including predator species. What is the latest on the gray wolf delisting?
Yeah, so this is one that we should have heard something in February, and surprise, surprise, the federal government did not get their homework done on time. So we were expecting a gray wolf delisting rule in February of 2024. The Fish and Wildlife Service has blown past that deadline and has indicated that they need more time to get this done. You know, we're disappointed that they couldn't get it done in the ample time, the year that was allotted previous to this, but if they say they need more time, that's kind of where we're at. We're at a little bit of an impasse there. So we are still awaiting a completion of that delisting rule. The service is currently working on, to our knowledge, a species status assessment for the lower 48 population. They have completed smaller subsets of that, most recently for the Western DPS and the Northern Rocky Mountains population. Those status assessments yielded the same conclusion that we've seen for several years here now, and that's very supported by the science. It is not warranted to list those DPSs under the ESA. And we think that the more populations that the service looks at in other parts of the country, and certainly evaluating wolves as a whole across the lower 48, they're going to arrive at the same conclusion. And they're going to say, we don't have reason to support an ESA listing of this species anymore. It's time to delist. We're obviously going to keep pushing forward with our court case. We're not going to put all of our eggs in the regulatory basket, but we do expect to get a favorable outcome there sometime before the end of 2024. The other item that I want to touch on with wolves that I think is pretty interesting and newsworthy in the last couple weeks here is we got a recent population survey back for the past previous year, 2023, on the Mexican gray wolf population. And this is a 10J population. It's a non-essential experimental population under the ESA of gray wolves found in Arizona and New Mexico. There's a lot of debate back and forth about how genetically distinct those two groups are now that there's been a lot of mixing between them, but the Fish counts them as a separate population. So the Mexican gray wolf population in those two states has increased for the eighth year in a row. This is a really solid sign that that population has a strong foothold, more than a foothold in the landscape. And we've seen that reflected in the fact that conflicts are growing. There's a lot more depredation that producers are experiencing in that area. And so we're going to continue to push also for lifted protections for the gray wolf, but specifically with an eye towards with that experimental population where there's a little bit more management flexibility. How do we deal with depredation now that that's becoming a much more common occurrence?
Sigrid, a couple of months ago, we talked about the Biden administration having a plan to introduce bears in the North Cascades ecosystem in Washington state. And I understand that there's a similar reintroduction effort underway in Montana and Idaho. What's the latest there?
Yeah, so just this week, in fact, we're wrapping up a scoping period, which is sort of a prelude to a full rulemaking that the agency does, in this case, Fish and Wildlife Service, when they're considering a new action. The one that they're looking at now in this scoping period is a reintroduction of more grizzly bears to the Bitterroot ecosystem. This is one of the designated grizzly bear recovery areas in the country. There's a couple. There's the GYE, the Greater Yellowstone. There's the North Cascades that you mentioned in Washington State that's gotten a lot of attention lately. And then the Bitterroot sort of spans the border of Idaho and Montana, and is actually one of two systems that impact Idaho. Idaho also has a decent chunk of the Selkirk ecosystem. But this effort to drop more bears into the Bitterroot is going to create a lot of the same problems that we identified in the North Cascades. It is also very strenuously opposed by local stakeholders on the ground, rural families, ranchers who don't want to deal with depredation, you know, folks who are concerned about their safety and their family's safety, and so on and so forth. What I think is pretty interesting is that from the Fish and Wildlife Service's perspective, you know, we're seeing this effort to spread out bears all over the country, all over the Northeast and the Northwest and the Upper Plains region, even in cases where it doesn't really make a lot of sense for the recovery of the species. And so when you look at this most recent idea that they've had for the Bitterroot, we've already gotten a lot of questions about why are they doing this? You know, is this going to lead to better outcomes for the species? And I think more than anything, what's motivating this is the fact that they have too many bears in the Greater Yellowstone. They have so many bears. They have become such a success story that they actually have to remove some and plop them into other ecosystems. So once again, I think this is an action that we can pretty firmly interpret as indicating that the bear is no longer in need of ESA protections, not that we need to double down on protections. They are reproducing, they are spreading out, they are traveling great distances. This is another predator species that is really well and truly recovered, and I think the actions that Fish and Wildlife is contemplating really need to catch up to reflect that.
So these are a lot of very specific and very complicated issues that Western ranchers face. But for folks who don't live in the West, this is a lot of new content for them. Could you sort of explain to producers who don't live in the West why it's important to be invested in some of these issues and pay attention to what's going on for Western ranchers?
Absolutely. So we are fortunate in many parts of the country that we don't have to think every day about the impact that the federal government might have on us. And that is the opposite for Western ranchers who are operating on public lands. You know, we often work at NCBA to try and keep the federal government out of as many portions of our business as possible because we think that folks can handle that by themselves. Getting the federal government footprint off of your business is not an option if you're a public lands grazing permittee. They are part and parcel of your business. And we really depend on access to that public forage. So I think it's an interesting case where a lot of the tactics that we see environmental groups, anti-animal agriculture activists, other groups like that that are opposed to grazing, they really test out a lot of their attacks and strategies first on public lands grazers because they know they have an in there through the federal estate, through what we call the federal nexus, the fact that the federal government is the landowner in that case. It's not an individual rancher or a family. And so they really have an opportunity there in many cases to try out lawsuits, to try out attacks, to try out talking points that are later going to be weaponized against ranchers across the country. It always ends up spilling over, but we see a lot of folks in the West being on the front lines of those attacks. And so we really encourage people back East and across the South and in other areas to pay attention to what's happening in the West, because unfortunately we know that, you know, if you give it long enough, if you give it a year or two, it's probably an attack that you're going to face in your own backyard as well.
Where does public lands ranching fit into the broader cattle industry as a whole?
So it's a very crucial element of the Western industry. And obviously, we have a lot of states in the West that are sort of key and foundational cattle states to the broader American cattle industry. But public lands grazing access is really important. By best estimates, and we're working to update this number now, actually, because it's a few years old, but by best estimates, about 40% of the Western cattle herd spends part of its life on public lands grazing allotments. That's a pretty big chunk. The economic revenue that public Parklands grazing generates just on BLM land alone is well over $1 billion annually. The ecosystem services that we provide every year on BLM and Forest Service land exceed $2 billion annually. So we're talking about a pretty significant economic footprint for all the folks who are really based in the cow-calf sector and produce a lot of the calves that are moving further east then to some of our feeding folks and our processors, obviously. But beyond that economic footprint and the sort of strong, heavy cow-calf presence that you have there, I think there's also a really significant environmental component. Public lands are held in trust for the American people. They are owned by the American taxpayer. But how many American taxpayers do you know are out, in the middle of Wyoming or Idaho or California or Oregon, making sure that the whole place doesn't catch on fire? How many are out there keeping track of the spread of cheatgrass and other invasive species that are choking out our native rangelands? How many are out there keeping an eye on wildlife populations and tracking depredation and tracking the health of the sage grouse and other species that we really care about conserving? It's ranchers, for the most part, who are out on the front lines doing that work, not just for themselves and for their operations, but also on behalf of the American taxpayer. And so I think they play a really important role in the health of our environment and our landscapes out there. And that's a role that is far, far too often underappreciated by the average American who, might like looking or watching, images of cowboys, but they don't understand how much work those folks are really doing in the West.
Well, Sigrid, thank you so much for the update today.
Thank you, Hunter.
This has been another episode of Beltway Beef. Don't forget to check us out online at policy.ncba.org or catch the podcast wherever you get your podcasts from, including SoundCloud, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts.